From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with writer Ed McBain, whose realistic police procedural mysteries are set in the fictitious 87th Precinct. Under his name Evan Hunter, he wrote The Blackboard Jungle and the screenplay for Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Also today, we learn the story of one of civilization's great inventions, the pencil. Henry Petrosky's written a sharp history of this simple tool. Rock critic Ken Tucker checks out two new rap albums. And film critic Stephen Schiff tells us whether he's thrilled by the new thriller, Everybody Wins. There are more than 8 million stories in the Naked City, and these are some of them on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Senate today upheld President Bush's veto of a bill protecting Chinese students from deportation. The vote was 62 to 37, for short of the two-thirds needed to override a presidential veto. President Bush said he was pleased with today's vote and said the U.S. would continue to urge the Chinese government to recognize its citizens' human rights. The president unveiled phase two of his national drug strategy today. It calls for $10.5 billion, a billion more than last year. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
Phase 2 offers no dramatic shifts from Phase 1 other than $300 million more for the military's role in drug interdiction. That was the largest single increase. Three areas get roughly the same amount: law enforcement in the United States, interdiction and international efforts, and finally, treatment, education, and prevention. The Conference of Mayors, meeting here in Washington, puts the drug war at the top of its agenda. They agree with the emphasis on interdiction, but said the $500 million in assistance for state and local law enforcement is far too little. Maureen O'Connor is the mayor of San Diego.
It's an 8.5% increase, which roughly is 17 cents per capita for enforcement throughout the country for local agencies.
Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden has his own plan, but wants to spend $4 billion more than the administration. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Colombian drug traffickers freed another hostage today as part of their plea for peace agreements with the government. The traffickers say they have no more prisoners and will begin turning over their cache of explosives next week. From Bogota, Leslie Werpsa reports.
Drug traffickers using the name The Extraditables freed their fifth hostage today in the city of Medellin. Juan Camilo Pelaez, the son of a wealthy Medellin businessman, was released with a message at around midday. The message he carried blames members of Colombia's police for other kidnappings and the massacre of 12 people last weekend near Medellin. In the message, the drug traffickers said they would offer proof that the police are involved in such crimes. The release of hostages was one of the promises the Medellin traffickers made in a peace proposal made public last week. On Monday, they turned over their most valuable hostage, the son of a close government advisor who was missing since late December. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
Saying the nation's unemployment compensation system is outdated and insufficient, members of Congress introduced legislation today that includes higher federal unemployment taxes. The sponsors cited a new report by the Congressional Research Service that warned of potential trouble ahead in state unemployment compensation programs because benefits have grown more rapidly than unemployment taxes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 43 points today to close at 2561.04. Declines led advances 9-5. This is NPR News. Negotiators today reached an agreement calling for a ceasefire along the border separating Armenian and Azerbaijani nationalists. The TASS news agency said the ceasefire was declared by members of the Soviet Parliament, the Armenian All National Movement, and the People's Front. The border region has been among the most tense in the bloody struggle between Armenian and Azerbaijani nationalists that erupted throughout two republics 2 weeks ago. United Airlines Board of Directors met today but did not receive a formal buyout bid from the newly formed Union Alliance. Julia McAvoy reports from Chicago.
The UAL board stated today that it would consider any acquisition proposal made by the employee group or any other third party, but said the letter it received from the union group yesterday did not constitute a formal acquisition proposal. Airline industry analyst Tim Petty of Merrill Lynch says the recent decision by the machinists union to join with pilots and flight attendants is just the first step in a long process toward a possible agreement.
There's quite a bit of ground yet to be covered. What has taken place insofar as the agreement with the unions is a necessary first step, but it does not ensure a transaction by any stretch of the imagination.
The UAL board also stated that it is still considering the possibility of a recapitalization. United stock closed down 3 points today, reflecting a 67% drop in fourth quarter earnings, a factor that may make any buyout plan difficult to finance. For National Public Radio, I'm Julia McAvoy in Chicago.
U.S. officials today turned a Senate hearing on water pollution into a forum to criticize European community farm and environment policies and to suggest new import duties on goods from nations with poor ecology protections. Minnesota Republican Rudy Boschwitz called European environmental practices outrageous, but farm subsidies, which the United States is seeking to reform, bore the brunt of the attack, encouraging high support for farm prices overseas. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson here for Terry Gross. Since 1956, when Ed McBain's police procedural, Cop Hater, hit the stands, the police of the 87th Precinct have solved murders and assaults while entertaining millions of readers who've come to know Meyer, Kling, and Corella as if they're from their own neighborhood. Ed McBain's written over 40 thrillers set in his fictitious precinct, but he's also written under his name Evan Hunter, The Blackboard Jungle, Streets of Gold, and Love, Dad. The film of The Blackboard Jungle helped make Bill Haley and the Comets' Rock Around the Clock a big hit in 1955. He also wrote the screenplay for Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, dozens of stories, plays, and science fiction. His 40th McBain police procedural, Lullaby, is on paperback bestseller lists, and his new 87th Precinct novel is called Vespers. When Evan Hunter stopped by, I asked him to read, as Ed McBain, a brief scene from Vespers to illustrate the way he builds fear and tension in a scene. A character, Arthur, we later learn is violent, comes home to his wife, Sally.
She always became apprehensive when he started drinking heavily before dinner. All the other times had happened when he'd come directly home from the store and started the evening by pouring himself a stiff drink. It was only a little past six now, and he'd already consumed two healthy gins over ice and was pouring himself a third one at the counter near the kitchen sink. Ice cube tray open on the counter. Tanqueray gin, he drank only the best. Tanqueray or Beefeater wouldn't allow a cheaper gin in the house. Asked her once if she knew that gin was made from juniper berries, and did she know that juniper berries were poisonous. She hadn't known whether he was kidding or not. He sometimes said things just to confuse her. He could be cruel that way. She never knew whether one of his drunken spells, she guessed you could call them, was triggered by something that had happened at the store that day, or whether they had something to do with the calendar or the phases of the moon or the tides, like a woman's period. She suspected there was something sexual about these spells of his, that what happened was some kind of substitute for sex, that he got off on first getting drunk and then you disapprove, right, he said. I'm making a nice dinner for us, she said, which means you disapprove, right? Pouring the gin liberally over the ice cubes in the short, fat tumbler, fingers curled around the glass. Outside there was thunder in the east. It had been days now since they'd had any rain. Rain would be welcome.
It's a menacing passage, and it's highly visual. Was this a scene that you imagined as you were writing it out on the page, or had the scene sort of come to you sort of full blown in your mind?
I think they usually evolve as I go along. You know, I start with the notion, I know what's going to happen in the scene, you know. I know that it's going to start with these two people talking and him drinking and drinking heavily, and I know it's going to end with violence. I don't know the details of their conversation, how the conversation will evolve, and I don't know in what form the violence will take. So at the end of this particular scene, he is taking more ice cubes out of the ice cube tray when he finally flips. He's a man who's a wife beater, and he abuses his wife constantly when he's drunk. And he uses the divider from the ice cube tray as a weapon to hit her with, you know. But this just came out of the blue as I was writing the scene. I didn't know he was going to use the divider from the ice cube tray, and I didn't know that when that proved insufficient to his needs, he would then pick up the gin bottle and swing that at her.
Is this pleasure of discovery part of the pleasure of what keeps you coming back to write?
Oh, absolutely. I hate to outline very far ahead, because when you do that, you know, if I knew exactly where a book was going from minute one, and I had outlined it chapter by chapter, scene by scene, then the rest is just typing, isn't it? This way, I invariably, I don't even know who committed the crime when I start the novel. I normally start with a corpse or someone about to become a corpse. In the case of Vespers, it's a priest at prayer. He's saying his evening prayers in the courtyard of the church when he's stabbed. But I didn't know who killed him or why. And I learn as I go along. As the police come in, I'm confronted with the same evidence the police have. They see a dead man on the sidewalk, on the courtyard stones, bleeding. And it's a lovely spring night, and his roses are blooming all over the garden, and it's a shameful night for someone to be murdered. But there he is, and the police see the results of violent crime, and they try to find out how it happened, and I try to find out along with them.
The title of your stories resonates throughout the entire book, and I wonder if, say, for instance, the beginning of Vespers was just the title Vespers, and from there you imagined the church, the cult of Satanism, the other kinds of violence that would come in at these times of day.
Yeah, it's I normally start. I'll get back to the actual title itself in a moment. But let me explain that I normally start a book with just the title. I had what for years I considered the alphabet subgenre of the 87 Precinct series, where each book would be a one-word title starting with a different letter of the alphabet: axe, bread, calypso, doll, fuzz, ghosts, etc., etc. And my wife and I constantly play the game, here's a good one for G, or here's a good one for R. R I haven't used yet. I'm still looking for a good one. But Vespers seemed a good one for V. I normally look for a title that has some sort of resonance to it, by which I mean when I was doing, for example, a novel called Ice. Ice, the very word dictated that the novel be set in the wintertime. Ice in criminal jargon means diamonds, so there had to be diamonds in the plot. Ice is, again, criminal slang for to kill someone, to ice him. Cocaine is snow, not quite ice, but nonetheless it had that close link to it. And ice is also a form of theatrical fraud, where a hit show, tickets are sold to a hit show at far above box office prices. So it had a lot of meanings to it. With Vespers, Vespers is the evening prayer, and one of the reviewers said about the book that I was working with a darker palette here, and I think I am. I think there's a sort of a despair for the city and perhaps the nation in this book. And it seemed a fitting title for the prayer that is said at evening. At one point, Corella wonders if perhaps it isn't too late to say Vespers.
The characters have evolved as the series has continued over the past, 35 years?
Since 1956, yeah.
And the characters still include Corella, Meyer Meyer, Bert Kling, and Hal Willis, who populate the 87th Precinct Station. The character Meyer Meyer, which showed up early on, was kind of like a joke in a way, I think, kind of like Major Major in Catch-22. And I wonder if you feel kind of badly stuck with his name, or you're just really pleased with it as the series has gone along.
Well, I don't even mention it anymore. The trouble with writing a continuing series is you have to explain about characters to the people who are meeting them for the first time. You know, I'm not egotistical enough to believe that everyone in the world is familiar with every novel in the 87 Precinct series. So I have to assume there are readers who are coming to it for the first time who don't know these people. and I have to describe them, and I have to describe their peculiarities, including a double-barreled name like Maya Maya. And but this gets increasingly more annoying to people who are familiar with the series and have read the books and say, please, don't tell me again how Maya Maya got his name. I'll go crazy. You know, they don't want to hear it. So I have to tread a very cautious line, like a tightrope walker up there, giving enough information to keep the new reader informed and not so much that it will turn off the old reader.
The technology of police work has changed. In Vespers, you have police using fax machines and photocopiers. How do you keep up with the changes of technology, and do you find... Do you find technology sort of an easy way to make plot shifts nowadays instead of the phone ringing and bringing new information and the fax machine delivers a note?
Clicks away, yeah. Mm-hmm. To answer the first part of your question first, I froze the police routine in my books a long time ago because it would be impossible to keep up with especially the New York City change of routine every book out, you know, would just be an impossible task. So I froze the routine, but I obviously did not freeze the technology, and I am very much aware of every new thing that comes along to help the police solve crimes, and I try to use it in the books.
My guest is Evan Hunter, who under the name Ed McBain writes the 87th Precinct Crime Detective series. His latest book is Vespers. His previous novel, Lullaby, is now on the paperback bestseller list. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Ed McBain, the author of the 87th Precinct Crime Detective series, also known under his real name of Evan Hunter. I know you've often been asked about your name because you've used several of them in your writing career. You were born Salvatore Lombino.
Well, we didn't call it quite that. Since it was America, we called it Salvatore.
Salvatore?
Salvatore, but that's what I was born with, yeah.
And
that's what they hung on me. As an unprotesting and unprotected infant in a cradle, they hung that name on me.
So you feel you've escaped out from under it then?
Oh, yeah. It would have been a beautiful name to grow up with in Italy, but certainly not in America. Not then. Not at that time. Now it's the times they have changed.
Do you regret having changed your name to Evan Hunter?
Absolutely not.
Uh-huh. The name Evan Hunter came from what, two schools that you attended?
No, that was some press agent invented that. The name Evan Hunter came from. This is going back so long ago. This was 1952 or 3. An editor suggested to me that it would be advisable if I used a pseudonym on the first book I was publishing. In the publishing climate of that day, he felt that a book with a blatantly Italian name on it would not sell very many copies. I think, incidentally, as a side thought, that there still is a lingering prejudice in America against people with Italian names or Italian-sounding names. Italians are expected to be ditch diggers and plumbers and taxi cab drivers, but they're certainly not expected to be writers. And you can count them on the fingers of one hand, the writers whose names are Italian, who are American. I'm not talking about the Italians, like Umberto Eco. But aside from that, so I changed the name, but I chose the name. I had used the name anyway I wrote many short stories before my first novel was published, and I had used the name on many of those stories. And it seemed to me to summon up a the hunter seemed appropriate for a young man who was ambitious and on the move, hopefully, which is wrong. No, hopefully on the move, I don't know. I always get confused with hopefully and I am hopeful, don't you? But
what was the caption in the New Yorker cartoon, man in a bar saying to another one, hopefully wise? Did I hear you say hopefully wise?
I love it. And Evan seemed, I liked the name Evan. There was a guy who used to work at this literary agency where I worked, and his name was Evan. And it seemed like a nice name, and I thought, okay, Evan Hunter, and here I am all these years later. And I've, you know, eventually my mother called me Evan, my wife called me Evan, everyone called me Evan, and I've been Evan longer than I ever was, the name I was born with.
How about the name McBain? I mean, you went from an Italian name to an Irish name.
That came out of the blue. We knew that, again, with the odd things that happened in publishing, mystery writing was considered a sort of a stepchild of literature. So many writers who wrote, John Marquand wrote the Mr. Moto series, but he also wrote so-called serious novels. Graham Greene called his mysteries entertainments as opposed to his serious novels. So it was thought after the success of The Blackboard Jungle and the fact that I had written several other, again, so-called serious novels afterward, that when I started the 87 Precinct series in 1956, it was thought wise by my editors, my agents, and me to use a pseudonym on it. They felt it would be detrimental to my serious career if it became known that I wrote mystery novels. So when I finished the first one, Cop Hater, I had no byline on it. And I went out into the kitchen where my former wife was feeding my twin sons, and I said, how does Ed McBain sound? And she said, good, and shoveled some pablum into their respective mouths. And I became Ed McBain.
It's a great story.
It's a true story, absolutely
yeah.
True.
In The Blackboard Jungle, the teacher who tries to come and bring order to the Manual Arts
Richard
High School.
Richard Dadier.
Dadier.
Yeah.
And there's the students make fun of, they come up with Daddy-O and tease him. Did Daddy-O resonate in your mind to make you come up with Dadier for the story? Or
I think so. I wanted something that they could harp on. Or yeah, I think so. Also, I was still very close to my maiden name at that time, and so I wanted something that sounded vaguely foreign, you know. And Dadier was not Italian, but it was certainly French in origin. There was a big lawsuit on that on Daddy-O and Dadier. There was a disc jockey in Chicago who called himself Daddy-O, and he claimed to have had a huge teenage audience. When the movie was shown, and you know the scene where they smashed the records, he claimed that there was a link to his show somehow, and his audience was falling off because the kids, since the records and disc, I don't know, all some kind of cockamamie relationship going on there, but he nonetheless sued MGM for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and me in the bargain. He lost the case, needless to say, but we had to get every jazz musician in America to testify at the trial in Chicago saying that Daddy-O was a common expression among musicians and that they had used it all their lives.
A lot of The Blackboard Jungle was based on your own experience teaching in vocational schools. Did you ever go through a scene like that in a classroom?
No, I never did. I had a tough time teaching. I felt myself totally unprepared for what was awaiting me in the public school system in New York City. They were giving out in those days what they called not substitute licenses, emergency licenses. Yeah, that was the exact word, emergency licenses to teach, and they were only valid in vocational high schools because nobody wanted to teach in them. So it was like putting someone who had just come out of basic training, putting him in the front lines in Vietnam. And I tried my very best. I hated every minute of it, and I tried my very best to entertain, to teach, to explore, to try to get something across to these kids, and you know, they just weren't buying it. And I quit very quickly.
I'm speaking with Evan Hunter, who writes under the name Ed McBain. But under the name Evan Hunter, you have worked as a screenwriter for Alfred Hitchcock, The Birds, and Akira Kurosawa. You've described your writing as one of discovery, a process of going along and not outlining, because the pleasure is in discovering what the characters are doing. Alfred Hitchcock always liked to storyboard and found the actual process of making the movie boring. And there seems to be sort of a similarity in your two approaches, in that the actual sort of mechanics of producing a book or mechanics of producing a movie aren't particularly interesting.
We worked the film out scene by scene, line by line, etc. In other of his films, this may have been the entire process in his mind, so it was no longer necessary to shoot the film. But I think with The Birds, he got a few surprises, because he didn't expect he was going to have so much difficulty getting the scenes that were on paper, getting them on film. You know, he was dealing with birds and animation and puppets and hand puppets and little toys on the kids' backs when they were running away from the birds, and the real birds themselves. And I think this had to have been an exciting voyage of discovery for him.
Were you on the set during the making of The Birds?
Only accidentally. I was writing the screenplay for Marnie, his next picture, and while they were shooting up in San Francisco, so I went up for story discussions on that.
What was your approach to adapting Daphne du Maurier's novel to the screen?
Well, the first thing Hitch told me was we're throwing away everything but the title, The Birds. So the approach was to start a whole new story with entirely new characters. The original novella was set in a farmhouse in Cornwall, and it was just the farmer and his wife. And the only thing that remained of that story was the scene where the Swifts come down the chimney into the room. Do you remember that in the movie?
Mm-hmm.
That was in the novella, but everything else is brand new.
So writing the screenplay for The Birds then was a process of discovery for you, just
in a sense, yeah. Uh-huh. I came out to the coast with some ideas, and Hitch had some ideas, and after the first two meetings, we discarded all the preconceived notions we had and started from scratch again.
The copyright for the 87th Precinct books is held by the Hui Corporation, H-U-I.
Hui.
Hui.
Yeah, well, that's the way I pronounce it. I don't know what the correct pronunciation is. I got it from a James Michener novel called Hawaii, where the Chinese family formed their... It's sort of a family corporation where they, as an example, if one member of the family owns a department store and it's making a lot of money and another member of the family wants to go to medical school, the family will meet and decide whether they should send them to medical school. And then they will send them to medical school, but when he becomes a doctor, he then puts all his earnings back into the Hui. I honestly don't know if that's the way it's pronounced. That's the way I've always pronounced it. It's a Chinese word. And when I first started this corporation, I conceived of it as a sort of a family thing. After all, it was only me and my wife. So.
I want to thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here.
Ed McBain's new book is Vespers. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the life of Jackson Pollock with his biographers, Stephen Nafe and Gregory White Smith. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Have you noticed that when you're writing very simply along with a pencil in the sentence and, oh, the tip breaks off? The pencil point always snaps off the same way? Well, that simple observation led civil engineer Henry Petrosky to ponder the pencil. The result is 450-page examination of the science, technology, history, and future of the pencil. Coming up, we meet Henry Petrosky. Rock critic Ken Tucker introduces us to new albums from the rap acts Jungle Brothers and Third Base. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Everybody Wins, starring Nick Nolte as a down-and-out private eye and Deborah Winger as a hooker with a secret. Revelations await you here on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate today failed to override the president's veto of a bill to allow Chinese students in the United States to stay here when their student visas expire. The vote was 62-37, just short of the two-thirds majority needed. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The House vote yesterday was overwhelming and bipartisan to override the veto. But today in the Senate, the debate was divided along party lines. The Republican leadership framed the issue as a vote for or against President Bush. A veto override was supported by all the Democrats and a handful of conservative and liberal Republicans. But the rest of the Republican senators heeded the call of their leaders and stuck by the president. The White House had pulled out all the stops to lobby for a vote to sustain the president's veto. For the first time, Republican National Committee Chairman Lee Atwater got involved in a congressional debate. There were reports that state Republican Party leaders were enlisted to put pressure on wavering Republican senators. In the end, the veto override effort fell 4 votes short. Only 8 Republican senators voted with the Democrats. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush today announced the nomination of former New York State Senator John Dunn to the sensitive top civil rights job at the Department of Justice. The post has been vacant for more than 1 year. If confirmed by the Senate, Dunn would follow William Bradford Reynolds, who played a controversial role in civil rights cases during the Reagan administration. Hungary's parliament has approved new rules to control the state security services after a telephone bugging scandal that forced the resignation of the interior minister this week. The opposition has produced evidence that it is still being kept under secret surveillance, even as democratic elections draw near. Sally Eckrod in Budapest has more.
It's the first time the Hungarian people have officially got to hear about the methods of the state security service, which operated in deep secrecy to fight dissent. In the wake of a scandal in which opposition parties proved their telephones were being tapped and their mail intercepted, Parliament's brought in new rules that clearly control the department and make it accountable to the public. From now on, the security service will have to get written permission from the Justice Minister if it wants to tap anyone's phone or violate normal rights to privacy. The minister, in turn, will report back every month to a committee on which the opposition will be well represented. Files compiled by the security service over 40 years have now been removed to the state archives, but not before many of them were shredded in a hurry. For National Public Radio, this is Sally Eckroyd in Budapest.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down 43.5 points to close at 2,561.04 on volume of 172 million shares. Trading was very active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Some people hear rap music and it all sounds the same to their ears, but rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of 2 new records that he says might change their minds. One's by the Jungle Brothers, and the other, the Cactus Album, is the debut album by Third Base. Here's the cut Son of Third Base.
Here's my advice to all amateurs planning to give a performance. Speak up and keep the act moving.
Six. Pete is 1-3. Third Base is a New York duo consisting of two white men in their 20s. Their stage names are MC Search and Prime Minister Pete Nice, but it's probably easier to call them by their real names, Michael Barron and Peter Nash. Barron and Nash make rap music that's chock full of pop music and pop cultural references. The song that began this review, called Sons of Third Base, uses as its organizing riff Spinnin' Wheel, the oldie by Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Taking decidedly unhip music and making it listenable again is a standard rap strategy, but Third Base does it even better than most acts, layering the stolen riffs with added original music and thick, knotty wordplay.
This recording is a collection of unintended indiscretions before microphone.
All right, man, it's good fun.
That's Oval Office, featuring a sexual lyric so ornate and sustained that it transcends dirtiness, though it's pretty wonderfully dirty. In any case, listening to it, it's not difficult to believe that Peter Nash is putting his graduate degree in English to good use. And I hope it's clear also from this music that Third Base is more than just the latest variation on the Beastie Boys. Although I admire the energetically vulgar jokes the Beasties make, their white boy rapper's comedy act isn't at all what Third Base is hoping to accomplish. Third Base, whose debut release is called The Cactus Album, acknowledges rap as an African-American creation. But they locate the common ground that enables whites to rap with conviction, not campiness.
Hey, yo, man, my label mate Don Newkirk, man, step to him.
Thanks, Search. And now for the Prime Minister.
Third Basal Express, KMD, three blind mics on site. Zev Lover gave it the first light. A grin shows a trick up a sleeve. What a tangled web they weave. Deceive is stupefied through fable. Say, let's make a deal at the dinner table. Put you on tour, put your record on wax.
Trust me!
Sign your life on the X. Your exit X over what you really get. A box of Newports and Puma sweats.
Damn.
In contrast to Third Base, there's the Jungle Brothers, whose second album, Done by the Forces of Nature, is a strong statement of black pride.
You don't know who you are. Look back into your past, brother. Look back into your past, sister.
You don't know who you are. Look back into your past, sister. Look back into your past, brother.
Father was a king. He wore fat gold chains and fat ruby rings. Nobody believes this to be true. Maybe it's because my eyes ain't blue. You ain't gonna find it in your history book. Come here, young blood, and take a look. You dig down deep inside this hardcover. Don't you know that you was barred, brother? All you read about is slavery. Never about the black man's bravery. You look at the pictures and all they show is African people with bones in their noses. That ain't true. That's a lie. You didn't get that from my lemon pie.
Yeah.
The Jungle Brothers emerged from Afrika Bambaataa's Zulu Nation, a New York coalition of musicians and community activists that over the past decade has worked hard to make life more meaningful for poor black youth. They present the idea of a future for young blacks expressed through positive role models that don't include assimilation into the white middle class. The Jungle Brothers are also one of the few acts around that acknowledges the sexism that's pervasive in a great deal of rap music, even if the brothers' attempt to correct this injustice is rather condescending to the women it addresses.
Black woman, mother of my earth, black woman, you gave me birth. You can truly see what's in me. You can help me be the best that I can be. You're feeding my fire when I'm on the wire. Keeping me calm when it's getting higher. Sweet like sugar and hot like wine. Always keeping you on my mind. Giving my life a new light to reach for. Giving me so much, how could I ask for more? Keeping us tight when we're getting loose. The darker the berry, the sweeter the juice, black woman.
Done by the Forces of Nature is a wonderful album whose ambitions seem boundless. Not content to make excellent rap music, The Jungle Brothers also try to connect with the history of black pop in a sweet doo-wop interlude called Cool According to a Jungle Brother.
I know this brother. Smooth like a cat.
Who's that?
So I look in the mirror and I patted him on his back. Yeah. Now I don't play when I do my thing. But you better call the cops.
Yeah.
If I start to sing, yeah. I got plenty moves. Eyes open, all eyes closed. But my best move, baby, is when I blow my nose. Africa, my brother, he lets loose when he lets go.
Yeah.
When the braids are in cool, braids out, G I Afro.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. This is Fresh Air. Children seem to intuitively know that a dull pencil is more reliable than a sharp one. Why a pencil point always breaks the same way has been a point of inquiry for engineers, including my guest, Henry Petrosky. Petrosky is a civil engineer and the author of the new book, The Pencil. Petrosky says he studied the simple pencil as a way to understanding engineering design. I asked him why he chose the pencil as his subject.
Well, what really first caught my eye was the fact that pencil leads sometimes break. And then it appears that they break in a rather predictable way. And this became somewhat of a challenge to explain why it is that the pencil point breaks always in the same place and always at the same angle and so forth.
Whereabouts does this happen for those who are still using pens?
Well, on a sharp pointed pencil, just out of a pencil sharpener, it will occur very close to the point. As the pencil dulls, and then if you press down and break, it'll occur further away from the point. It turns out, however, there's always a constant ratio of the sharpness of the point to where it breaks. And that's what makes it interesting from an engineering point of view. It seems to be a very predictable and reproducible type of thing.
And what did you find when you investigated this breakage point?
Well, I found that there were some people that actually investigated it earlier, which made it an interesting problem. But they couldn't quite explain why the pencil point broke off at a slant. And it turns out that became somewhat of a challenge. And by looking into things like that, it's helpful for people like me to explain to students the necessity of careful analysis in engineering.
And how is the process of careful analysis tied in with this then?
Well, if, for example, some people who are looking at pencil points can't explain why they break at a certain angle, then there's something wrong with their analysis. There's something that they don't quite understand. Now, if they're using that same kind of reasoning or similar kind of analysis to build a bridge or build a skyscraper, then there's a potential danger inherent in the design. And since my work has involved structural failures and engineering disasters, this was especially interesting to me because I'm especially interested in knowing why mistakes are made in the design process.
What were some of the design problems that allowed for the creation of the pencil? What was needed that allowed for the development of the pencil?
Well, what was needed was something that was really a portable writing instrument. There were quills and reeds and ink for a long time, but these were very inconvenient, especially for people who wanted to go out and do things out in the field, let's say. The first illustration of a pencil, for example, comes from a naturalist who was interested in collecting fossils. Conrad Gessner, in the 16th century, illustrated this new pencil that he had found because it enabled him to climb rocks and make sketches without having to worry about spilling his ink.
This was an attempt to develop a portable writing instrument that wouldn't leak in your pocket.
That's correct, and also that would make a sufficiently dark mark because the old pure lead that was used didn't make a sufficiently dark mark to be very useful. The pencil also had the advantage, the graphite pencil, of having an erasable mark. And this meant that if you made a mistake in your sketch, you could correct it without having to really throw away the piece of paper.
How did you move from the curiosity and the design of the pencil and its strengths and weaknesses into some of the literary history of it and how authors used it? And what moved you in that direction, away from the strict engineering studies?
Well, I wanted to make the book appealing to a wide range of readers, and I also wanted to have some diversion of my own while I was writing the book, and I was just curious about how writers wrote. I've always been interested in how writers compose their work and whether they use a pencil or a pen. I thought I would go to Bartlett's and just find some interesting quotes to sprinkle throughout the book. I discovered that there are very, very few references to the pencil in Bartlett's familiar quotations, whereas the pen has almost a full column of references in the index. This didn't seem right to me because I was sure that there were more authors that used the pencil. Maybe they just didn't write about it. And as I looked around, I discovered that, sure enough, that's the case. John Steinbeck, for example, goes on and on about what kind of pencil he wanted to use to write East of Eden. And yet, there's really no trace of this in the conventional literary references to his work.
So I remember reading Steinbeck's Journal of a Novel, and it's just filled with his preoccupation with the length of the pencil, how he happened to sharpen it, you know, at what point he'd throw it away.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
John Updike also told a story about how he writes. He said that he uses a word processor to write his columns and his reviews. He uses a typewriter to write his novels, and he uses the pencils that the New Yorker supplies that he lifted from them because they have just this nice softness to them that allows the words of a poem to flow nicely from.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that, but if I had known that, I would have tried to integrate it into the book.
The second edition.
Perhaps.
Well, I guess I have to ask then, what did you use to write your book?
A word processor.
Did you feel any sort of disloyalty or a sort of a technological improvement?
I don't think I thought much about it. I used to write exclusively with a pencil. When I was younger and wrote poems, that seemed to be the natural thing to use. But as I have grown older and began to write longer and longer things, such as book-length manuscripts, the word processor just seems to be the natural thing to do.
Have you come across people who collect pencils?
Yes, I have. There's an American Pencil Collector Society that has, I think, about 300 active members right now. And they are avid pencil collectors that are organized. They have a monthly newsletter, and they exchange pencils imprinted with their names and addresses. They tend not to sharpen pencils. They will tend to write in ink rather than use a pencil out of their collection.
What is your fear regarding your association with this book on the pencil?
My fear? Mm-hmm.
That maybe you'll be labeled, the pencil man or...
No, I've already been labeled that. I have no... It's too late for that. I think at one point I had a fear that it would be looked upon as a piece of frivolous work, and I think there are some serious, it's certainly a serious piece of scholarship without, I hope, being ponderous. It also, I think, has some real significant lessons for some of the current problems that we're experiencing in the United States today. The history of the pencil shows the importance of really keeping up in a research and development sense, with the competition, meaning the international competition. In the short 400-year history of the pencil, we've seen the epitome of the pencil go from the English pencil to the French pencil to the German pencil to the American pencil, and now it seems to me that the Japanese pencil is possibly threatening to be the top pencil in the world.
What have the Japanese pencil engineers brought to the pencil?
Well, they seem to have brought more research and development than some of the American firms have been willing to invest.
How does that pay off in the actual pencil itself?
Well, it produces a lead that is smoother, more flexible. The thin leads that are in a lot of the new mechanical and automatic pencils have really come from Japan. Japan has taken the initiative, at least. The pencils write very smoothly. They write a very, very fine line. They don't have to be sharpened. There are even pencils coming out now that don't even have to be, the lead doesn't even have to be advanced. It does it automatically.
You've said that engineering can be its own worst publicist because the more it succeeds in making a product or service that's reliable and efficient, the more engineering itself becomes virtually invisible and seemingly humdrum. Can you talk a bit about the importance of failure in an engineer's work?
Well, this really relates to my first book, called To Engineer as Human. I set out in writing that book to try to understand and explain to the layman why it is that some of the most embarrassing engineering accidents have happened, such as the hotel in Kansas City that had some skywalks collapse a few years ago, airplane crashes, famous bridge collapses. Why are these things happening? And it seemed to me that in reflecting on this, it was because the idea of failure, how things can go wrong, how structure can collapse, is not properly anticipated. It appears that engineering is much, much more complicated than the conventional wisdom has it. There are definitions of engineering that say that it's merely applied science. Well, the problem with that is that engineers are really creating something out of nothing. To build a bridge over, say, the East River in New York or the Golden Gate in San Francisco is to really be very creative, almost at the level of an artist. You have to conceive what this bridge is going to look like, what it's going to be made of. There are no equations of physics or chemistry that tell you these things. Once you've sketched out, usually in pencil, by the way, the outline of a bridge, then you can go to the sciences and analyze what the creative part of engineering has put down. So the sciences really follow engineering rather than lead it. And in exploring things like this, I conclude and argue that failure is the key concept. If you properly anticipate how something can fail, then you can go ahead and design to obviate that way of failing. It's when you don't properly anticipate what can go wrong that Murphy's Law seems to take over.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, thank you.
Henry Petrosky is a professor of civil engineering at Duke University and the author of The Pencil. It's published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Later today here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, host Robert Siegel has stopped by to give us a preview. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Sedge. We'll be hearing today about the Senate's sustaining President Bush's veto of the extension of visas for Chinese students. The president was overridden by the House, but the Senate vote today means that his veto stands. So he did not lose a big foreign policy vote in the Congress after all. We'll also be hearing about the visit of Czechoslovakia's president, Václav Havel, the playwright, to Poland, where he made a speech calling for a partnership of Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, and that those three countries should cooperate in political, economic means, and also in arms control.
Thank you, Robert. Another full edition of All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. Everybody Wins is a new movie that had some established and successful people working on it. Arthur Miller, Deborah Winger, Nick Nolte. But film critic Stephen Schiff wonders why Everybody Wins is such a loser.
A good movie, of course, can be the best thing in the world. But when you can't have good, sometimes incredibly terrible is better than merely mediocre. A movie as insanely, ambitiously misbegotten as Everybody Wins can be instructive and even entertaining between groans. It certainly doesn't feel like the same old crud. Everybody Wins was written by no less than Arthur Miller. It was directed by Carol Rice, who in better years made movies like Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, and Who'll Stop the Rain. It stars Nick Nolte and Deborah Winger, both terrific actors, and it has a score that includes some jolly renditions by Leon Redbone. What could go so wrong? Well, everything. Arthur Miller, for one thing, has been shockingly past his prime for eons now, and his screenplay is full of hilariously tortured, poetic, tough guy dialogue. The plot is more tortured still. Nolte plays Tom O'Toole, a Boston investigator who goes to the tiny Connecticut town of Highbury to help obtain the release of a boy wrongly convicted of murder. The woman who lures him to Highbury is Weird Angela, played by Winger, who at first seems a little mysterious and then a little slutty. Practically the first thing she does is seduce Tom. But where the plot really goes off the rails is when we find out that Angela is a split personality to boot, a schizo with a heart of gold. And though she knows all about the truth behind the murder, she doesn't want to tell. All of which makes Tom mad, but in a poetic sort of way.
You called me in to dig up just enough to get Felix out. Is that it? But without touching anybody else. And now you're asking me to protect them? To put them in there? You've been trying to go north, south, and powder your nose all in the same time. But that can't be done, baby, not with me.
Please, Tom.
Please, Tom is right. No one on earth could pull off dialogue like that. The director seems to have been out having a smoke during most of the scenes Winger and Nolte share. Those scenes are choppy and amateurish, and their rhythm is way off. Nolte has been given a bizarre Prince Valiant haircut and a kind of writer-in-residence goatee. He doesn't look quite clean somehow. But these are not the worst of his problems. He's been cast as a bewildered innocent in a whirlpool of corruption. And if you want bewilderment and innocence, Nolte, who's all toughness and capability, is the wrong guy. Winger's troubles are even more dire. Moving from one part of a split personality to another is probably a terrific acting class exercise. Unfortunately, that's the way Winger plays it. She's never been this maladroit in a movie before, and come to think of it, she looks oddly unkempt too, which doesn't help when she has to convince us that she's Highbury's femme fatale. The strangest thing of all is the way Miller has constructed his fantastically twisted plot, creating a hint of menace after the movie's first third, and then snipping it out after the second. This way, the picture has no suspense and no payoff, although it does have more complications per minute than a Nintendo game. Everybody Wins, in short, is not a pretty sight, but it's also not without its pleasures. Just as we, among the great unwashed, can sometimes outstrip our limitations by identifying with the glamour pusses up on the screen, we may also feel oddly elated to see those same glamour pusses looking lost, awkward, and greatly unwashed themselves.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Sage Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, biographers Stephen Nafe and Gregory White Smith talk about their heavily researched and graphic account of the life and times of painter Jackson Pollock and geographer Wilbur Zielinski on how maps can depict who we are as graphically as where we are. That and more next time on Fresh Air.